You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this. A very good morning to you. Welcome along to Monday morning's OTB AM. We're here with you every morning from 7:45 until around about 9:30, talking about the big stories in the world of sport and some other stuff as well. It's going to be an interesting week for us and for you, hopefully. The Champions League rolls back into action at the weekend. There's some other good stuff happening, like the Masters. There'll be like Tiger, High of the Tiger and Tiger Stroll headlines that we saw yesterday rolled out again next Sunday.
Yeah, I see Tiger Roll has really just become the utilised pun across all the papers today. There's a headline around Tyler Blaindell, it's called Tyler Roll. So it's just become the thing that's taken and run with.
Well, that's not bad, Tyler Roll, I like that. I thought High of the Tiger was good.
Yeah, that's like it's all going to be used up by the time Tiger inevitably dons another green jacket this weekend, which is...
It doesn't, obviously, there's no cause and effect here. I mean, there might be. I did like the person who was up in all our mentions going, but hang on, there's a documentary that proves that Yuri Geller is not really what he says he is. I'm like, I mean, come on, you know, like...
That's my dreams shattered. I need to reevaluate where I'm at in life. Is it like going into the Masters, it's a lot of dormant hype, isn't there? Because last year it's like, I can't wait now for next April for Augusta.
For Patrick Reed to win again.
Well, like finally when we have Tiger back in the mix, potentially going down the home stretch at Augusta, we're going to have Rory back. And it just seems that maybe Tiger's start to 2019 has kind of punctured that a little bit. Did we need Tiger to get fully excited about this from the off?
There's still the outside chance that he's going to be competitive and relevant. And it's not even that outside. He should be competitive and relevant because the field seems to have come back to him a bit. He's improved a little bit. You think he's not going to be relevant?
I don't think so, no. I think Jordan Spieth is going to win this weekend. I think Rory McIlroy is going to have another good week. People will still call him a bottler because he finishes fourth on the Sunday of the Masters, despite the fact that he might have been second going into the final day. He'll still be lambasted from all corners despite putting in a good week and a very consistent start to the season. It'll just be the predictable storylines once again. The fairy tales at Augusta are a thing of the past. Patrick Reed proved that last year by, you know, being the bully that won it.
No, I think there's like an equally horrific possibility of Matt Kuchar winning this year and everybody literally going boo and then going, they are booing him, yes.
He would be the only kind of possibility where things could get a little bit less popular than Patrick Reed. It hasn't been a great few months for Matt Kuchar. Like, I don't know.
He's in great form.
When was the last time we had a fairy tale at Augusta?
I mean, what do you classify as this? When which one of these millionaires wins more money, what's the bit about Augusta that is a fairy tale?
The comeback from a kind of a career, potentially career-ending injury.
Is that?
Let's go back to you can use Larry Mize.
Ray Floyd.
Or it depends what.
He got beaten, didn't he?
Like a miracle doesn't necessarily have to be a positive thing. A miracle is just a strange thing that occurs. Like is Jean Van de Velde the last miracle we've seen
in golf
at Augusta because it was literally a miraculous bottle drop. Which, of course, has been brought back into the public consciousness via Netflix over the past couple of weeks. I'm not sure if you've seen it. The Losers series, they did a special 20-minute section on Jean Van de Velde.
Yeah.
And
at the Open.
At the Open, of course, in golf, rather than just at the Masters in general.
Right.
When you talk about all the different majors, I mean, is that the last time we've actually had something that was so bizarre that kind of had us wide-eyed and we're like, what the hell is going on here?
Rory McIlroy found a new building that nobody knew existed in Augusta a couple of years back.
It's a bigger bottle job, is it? Do you reckon?
I mean, it's not as big in that it's as spectacular and it's more drawn out. Van de Velde is like 20 minutes, the whole world.
But do you take Jordan Spieth a couple of years ago as a miracle, depending on your outlook on life again? Maybe a miracle does need to be a positive thing.
The bottle or the win?
The bottle.
Yeah. There was one of those years Spieth just started sinking the putts from wherever he was in the green. They just went in, drop, like three or four in a row, and the tournament was over.
Yeah.
Tourney.
That was the last one he won, wasn't it? Here's the actual question that we'll be asking this time next week. If Rory McIlroy is Masters champion, is he the front runner for Sports Personality of the Year? Because this morning, Kieran Cunningham is making the point that Tiger Roll should be considered for RT Sports Personality of the Year.
Davey Russell, Gordon Elliott, do they not get it? It's the horse that gets it. I mean, it's then Michael O'Leary gets to keep it because he's the owner of the horse.
Maybe Michael.
The trophy, basically.
Who gets the trophy is the question. If this was an American contest, Tiger Roll would be the person that gets into contention for it. I think Justify was nominated for Sports Illustrated Sports Person of the Year a couple of years ago. In an Irish context, it probably is Davey Russell or Gordon Elliott. It's probably going to be Gordon Elliott. I don't know. I think it's an interesting discussion to have, that maybe it could be a bad Irish sporting year and a horse will end up winning the trophy.
I mean, apparently the BBC Sports Personality of the Year, Tiger Roll is short odds for that already.
Right, okay. Well, Rory McIlroy will also contend for that.
For those asking, I suspect Tiger Roll would not be eligible for BBC Sports Personality as he is a horse. Interested in leg, Tiger Roll got a hero status after joining a select band of double Grand National winners. In fairness, like, it's the biggest sports event in England over the entire weekend. Two FA Cup semi-finals notwithstanding, because they weren't... I mean, one of them was really good. The other one was an early goal for Man City and the game was over, which is exactly the pattern of stuff that we've been talking about. So, you know, there's a good chance that every 10 million people watch the race. 300,000 watch the preview. Like 2 hours before the event.
Like, why can't a horse qualify for Sports Personality of the Year?
That's a good point, yeah.
They've actually saved themselves by using the phrase personality rather than person.
Yeah, because he's Irish.
Well, obviously that's the thing. Like, I mean, we've got pictures on the back pages here of the horse rolling around, like actually living up to his name. This is a horse, this is not a human. It's a horse with a sense of humour, I dare say. It's a horse with personality.
Davey Russell says he reacts to his name, so, I mean, that'd be... I mean, why not? Let the horse be the personality of the year, why not?
Yeah, like...
The British one, the Irish one, we can give somebody else.
Well, let's hope that there will perhaps be a big rugby story or something at the end of this year to actually justify that, going that way for a sports personality.
It'll be Eddie Jones. If England win, it'll be Eddie Jones, won't it? They'll have to give it to Eddie Jones.
Or whoever. It'll be Owen Farrell. They'll do everything in their power to not give it to Eddie Jones.
Yeah, so it will be Owen Farrell. So this is going to be a strange week for us here too, because... Well, Owen and Tommy are not here for a couple of days. They're swanning around trying to, like, spot White Walkers and, you know, other bits of Game of Thrones memorabilia.
What does the phrase swanning around even mean? It's been bandied around quite a bit here over the past couple of weeks. Like, what do you actually do when you're swanning around?
I think afternoon drinking is involved.
Oh, right, okay. Well, absolutely. If we're swanning around, then I'm definitely up for swanning around over the next couple of days. We are going to Belfast with Off the Wall, brand new Game of Thrones podcast with Andy Lee, who knows everything about Game of Thrones. We're going up to Belfast tomorrow morning for like 36 hours or so to see all the sites, to kind of see where it's filmed, the big locations, where the magic happens, I guess. The magic and the pre-CGI magic, and we'll be bringing some very exclusive content. I can't give too much away just yet. Look, there'll be some very special content coming from Belfast.
Loads of stuff from the there's the Twitter account @offthewall_GOT. Yeah, loads of the Iron Island stuff, which is my least favourite bit. That's all up the north, isn't it?
Yep, it is. That's part of it. There's other sections of it as well. Like the King's Road is up there.
The King's Road is the hedges.
Yeah, I've been up there before, and I've done it before a few years ago. And our tour guide on that occasion said that the wall was up there, which doesn't really make sense considering some of it is shot in Iceland as well, isn't it? But I think there's a section of wall that is blown up on our screens to actually represent what it really is. So I think they do a bit of filming there as well. We're going to be doing a bit of archery. I dare say that the former world champion boxer is probably going to be better at us at using his hands in that regard. Or maybe not. Maybe there's absolutely no correlation whatsoever. We'll soon find that out. And there's plenty of other things as well on the itinerary.
Okay, all right. So we'll be getting live updates from the lads ahead of the return of Game of Thrones, which is next week.
Next week. This next week it'll all be revealed. Well, probably nothing. It'll probably just be more twists before things get unknotted over the following weeks.
Okay. You're looking forward to it.
I can't wait, I'm buzzing.
Right, let's bring you to what's coming up on the show. Sports Page is coming your way right now. Football, Graham Hunter, big week in the Champions League. Barcelona against Man United. Barcelona beat Atleti 2-0 on Saturday night. Late goals. Luis Suarez obviously doing a little bit of damage. Big story from that one though is how unhappy Diego Simeone was afterwards with the referee. We'll get the details of that from Graham in a couple of minutes' time. We're going to talk about the Grand National around about 8:25. Sports news around about 8:40 from Tom Malone. Alan Quinlan going to join us at 8:45 to talk to us about the weekend's rugby. An interesting weekend from the Pro 14 perspective, and countdown proper to the semi-finals is underway for the Heineken Champions Cup. Midlands GAA, a big win for Westmeath against Laois, and Becky Lynch's win in overnight in the WWE. Darren was over there, his final duty as an off-the-ball reporter, and if we can rouse him the way that Becky Lynch roused Rhonda. Well,
you're on your own there, Ger. not gonna help you out of that one.
On an island, right. Let's move on and bring the newspapers. It's funny, Becky isn't in the back of any of the pages. I'm sure they knew the result. Watford stage, great escape. This is coming from 2-0 down to win 3-2 in extra time in the Cup semi-final. But the picture there is from Hong Kong, and it's the Ireland Rugby Sevens team having secured a place in the top division. Is that what happened?
In the World Cup, I think.
Yeah, in the World Cup. And then Scorn Strachan has lost his role as a pundit on Sky after his remarkable comments about Adam Johnson. If he goes out to the pitch and people start calling him names, have we got to do the same as it is to the racist situation? Is it all right to call him names now after doing his 3 years? Have we got to allow that to happen? The Gordon Strachan thing, I did think that when you're watching it live, you're like, or watching the repeat on, well, Strachan's going to have an interesting point here. It's like, you know, what did he say? What? Oh. But the backlash, T-minus 15 minutes, people going, oh, what? Can Gordon Strachan, is he not freedom of speech? We're about 15 seconds away from that. De La Feo turned Watford fairy tale into a story of the mouse that roared. Well, that's an interesting headline. O'Leary unlikely to allow Tiger Roll bid for three. Mixed reports in the newspapers today about whether or not we're going to see Tiger Roll potentially go for three in a row. I mean, A bit remarkable if they didn't at this point. But anyway, Sexton remains a doubt for big games to come, so injury concerns for Leinster.
The Mirror this morning goes with Feu, what a scorcher. Deli Feu turns his anger over snubbing. His name is Deli Feu.
Feu.
So, Feu, what a scorcher. Let's go with that then. He turned his anger over snubbing to a stunning match-winning comeback as Hornets sting Wolves. And there's that photo I was mentioning, carried in a lot of the papers. National legend Tiger, .. rolls. And City boss Guardiola says, don't quaff, I want a quad. That's what Pep is saying this morning. Nearly impossible, he's saying.
Yeah, but no. Okay, so the People's Horse is the front page headline on the Racing Post over a picture of Tiger Roll through the streets of Meath. Seven pages of Tiger Roll's homecoming, if you want to luxuriate in the glory of Tiger Roll this morning. Pictures of Eddie O'Leary, Michael O'Leary, and Gordon Elliott with the trophy and the money.
The Herald leads with the headline, what a comeback, Doherty goal not enough as Wolves crash out at Wembley. And De Bruyne says, I don't care about your new stadium. Trash talking Spurs.
Well,
saying everybody's got a stadium.
Everybody's,
if it was Wembley,
fans,
there'd still be thousands and thousands of people there.
Yeah.
I don't care about the fact that your pint's filled from the bottom. It's going to have no bearing on the match, apparently.
The pint's filling from the bottom, not that big a deal. They have it everywhere. National hero. Racing's rock and roll star joins the sports immortals. It is pretty amazing. It was like in so controlled a finish as well. Did you watch it?
Yeah, it was.
Did you back it?
I did not. A lot of people suggesting that it was a very, very unwise move to back a horse at that short odds for a Grand National.
It was. It was unwise, but also profitable.
Mm-hmm. You've made a lot of money off Tiger Roll, haven't you?
Well, Tiger Roll was part of our double a couple of years back. Three Cheltenhams ago now at this stage, where completely unheralded. And what do you? It was on the first day, Stop. I didn't back it as much as everybody else did. And none of us had him backed when he made his seasonal debut, like 33-1, three races ago in like a small race. Was it Navan? He pissed off.
Navan, I think, yeah.
50 lengths. You're like, why did everybody not back Tiger all that day?
The Sun this morning leads with terrific stuff. De Lu Feu turned game our way, says delighted boss Gracia. And in at the feet end, Seamus Coleman reckons the form enjoyed by Ireland and Everton is proof that positivity can pay off. The Toffees earned a third win in a row yesterday, and speaking at Goodison Park afterwards, he said, "You have to play on the front foot at all times." That's where the pun comes from. So playing on the front foot in at the feet end is where those two things match up. Unai, ever so angry, has Everton beat Arsenal 1-0.
They don't match up. In at the feet end does not match up with
playing on the front foot.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't match up.
They did play in the front foot. I was watching Jim Beglin describe Arsenal yesterday as snowflakey. I haven't really heard a team described as snowflakey by somebody, and I was kind of angry for a little while, then I was like, actually no, he's totally right.
And it's also genius.
Yeah, well, it is. I'm sure that Arsenal team love avocados and aren't actually saving for a mortgage either.
Doherty's despair. Wolves blow 2-0 lead to miss out on FA Cup final day. But Dubner again shows why Mick McCarthy should find a place for him in the Ireland starting lineup. It did strike me that, have we all forgotten about the beginning of Mick McCarthy's career as Ireland manager, when he would relentlessly play players out of position for like entire campaigns? Ian Hart was a centre back as a 17-year-old. Roy Keane was also famously a centre back for one game against Iceland. Why the hell now has he suddenly decided, no, we absolutely cannot ever play this player out of position?
Has he decided that? Because it seems to have been based on the fact that he deemed him to be the fall guy for a poor performance in Gibraltar, no?
I mean, yeah. It's one other last thing. I just wanted, Dick Clerken is talking about the age profile of the Dublin football team. You can skip the first two paragraphs because he says get to the point at the start of the third one. In 2011, Dublin won the first of their six All-Irelands in the 8 years since. 10 players involved in that breakthrough team are still part of Gavin's five-in-a-row chasing panel. Cluxton, Philly, Mick Fitzsimons, Keane O'Sullivan, James McCarthy, Michael Dermacauley, Paul Flynn, Kevin McManaman, Bernard Brogan and Owen O'Gara. Throw in Dear McConnelly and Rory O'Carroll. And their collective achievements, 68 Celtic crosses, 28 All-Stars, 2 Players of the Year. They will have a combined average age of 33 by the time this year's All-Ireland final comes around. Is that too old? Are the Dubs too old? Is Dick Clerken giving them dressing room bulletin board material?
We'll come back to that in just a moment. Just to bring you through the rest of the back pages, the Irish Daily Mail leads with "Take It As Read, O'Leary's Tiger Vow." And the Irish Daily Star goes with "Stinging." I'm really struggling with these daily failure puns. "Stringing the Dayu."
"Stinging the..."
Stinging the Dayu, because that rhymes with tail. Dale LeFayu. Stinging the Dale. "Buzzing Hornets, Stun Wolves." You see, this is what happens when this is what happens when Watford aren't on the back pages so often. This is the true meaning of the FA Cup. You get on the back pages and you get presenters in tongue twisters. "People's Champion returns home," then, as well, as the headline on the horse racing. "O'Leary says treble bid, though, is very, very unlikely." And then "Pep takes big pop at Poch. Pep Guardiola has told Tottenham that big clubs don't make excuses ahead of their Champions League showdown."
"Deadly Few stuns Nuno. Fury at bench now fires Hornets 2-goal super." That's the English UA Daily Star. "Deadly Few stuns..." What?
Yeah, like instead of "Daily Feu."
"Deadly Feu."
Deadly Feu.
Okay. That's not as shit as it looked when I was reading it badly.
This is like the biggest snake pit of a pun situation I've ever been in.
Here's the Irish News. Not a pun on Watford. It's to do with Antrim GA. "Harbinson frustrated at not having a place to call home. Casement saga, real hindrance to progress," says the Antrim boss. Lenny Harbinson, who is the Antrim football boss, is saying that the absolute nonsense around Casement is obviously significantly difficult for them. 6 years since they've had a stadium to call home.
What's going on there? I haven't been following this. As in, it's just constantly, there hasn't been any movement whatsoever since those pictures emerged last year of the overgrown ground.
Well, that's obviously 5 years into the 6 year process, so I don't think anything's changed in the last year. Where are we going? First few stories?
Well, let's just double back on the Dick Clerken story. So an average age of 33 basically is the question of the 12 apostles that he calls. Now, to be fair, those 12 players do include Rory O'Carroll and Dermot Connolly. So perhaps you could bring that average age down a little bit. But he's right, isn't he? Like 33 is probably a tad too old to be a team-wide average age.
I think Connolly would be 33. And I think Rory O'Carroll would actually be bringing your age down, no?
Yeah, no, but sorry, but then you're including all the other players you've listed off. So you're including Clarkson, McMahon, Fitzsimons, O'Sullivan, McCarthy, Michael Darren, McCauley, Paul Finn, Kevin McManaman, Bernard Brogan, Owen O'Gara, and then Conley and O'Carroll. The average age of them is 33.
Yeah, but if you bring in, you're including O'Carroll and, just to be pedantic about it, including Conley and O'Carroll is actually reducing the average age because they're both younger than the... Roy O'Carroll's only 29, and I'm pretty sure that...
Yeah, no, obviously that's the case. Then, but like that's bringing it down to 33.
I'm 31, actually.
Either way, that's injecting relative youth into the experienced cohort of players in the Dublin panel, which kind of adds to the sense that this is a bit of a no-brainer. Potentially it is a bit of a no-brainer. Who knows what's actually going on at the moment? Like, the fact is, how much of these players are they actually relying on? Like, you have...
How many starters have you got?
Stephen Clarkson, starter. Philly McMahon... probably a starter. You can look at himself and Michael Fitzsimons, one of them is going to be a starter. Keane O'Sullivan's going to be a starter, you'd imagine. James McCarthy's going to be a starter. Michael Darren McCauley, probably in the balance of things, is going to be a starter. Paul Finn, not going to be a starter. Kevin McManaman, not going to be a starter. Bernard Brogan, Owen O'Gara, probably not going to be starters. That's only five, really. And then you have Dermot Connolly and Rory O'Carroll on top of that. So I'm giving them five starters in that. And suddenly then the whole idea of father time ticking away in Dublin doesn't look as severe as it might do. The thing is, like, it's not only the players who are in their pomp at the moment, the players between the ages of 26 and 28 that the clerk can say are in their peak athletic performance.
James McCarthy's 29. Just turned 29.
Yeah, he's probably still peak athletic performance.
Absolutely peak athletic performance.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's...
And also, where's the science behind the 26, 29?
Well, I don't know, as I say, that's what the clerk is saying, is peak athletic performance, but I don't know. I haven't obviously reached peak athletic performance yet, and I can't wait to reach it very, very shortly. Brian Fenton, Jack McCaffrey, Brian Harrow, Kieran Kilkenny, like he mentions them here, they're all below that age, or just below that age. They're about to become peak players over the next couple of years, and then you add in the potential cohort of youngsters that are younger than that again. Like, Dublin are fine age-wise. It's just... Like, I wonder, is it possible for any human being to actually look at players of this quality with that amount of All-Ireland medals and actually treat them the same as other people in the squad? Like, are you really looking at Philly McMahon and Owen Merchant and saying to yourself, yeah, no, I'm 100% giving you guys an equal footing? It must be a little bit difficult to think that because of what Philly McMahon can do on the big day. Now, granted, Owen Merchant has had a pretty stellar start in his Dublin career.
But isn't Jim Gavin, Brian Cody, the second version, and so therefore happy to cut people?
Like,
whenever he needs to.
Yeah, like I'm sure he is as cold as can be whenever he needs to be. But I don't know. I think there has to be some sort of human element in this that you're thinking to yourself, we're going to saunter through Leinster. There's a possibility we could saunter through the Super 8s depending on how things go. There's two games here to win the five in a row. Who am I backing if it comes down to it? Is form going to come into it? Like, of course it's going to play a part, but I'm not sure. I think it's hard to not get sentimental, and sentimental isn't even the right word. It's based on past performances. There is kind of the learned experiences
of being
in ridiculously high pressure situations in Croke Park.
Yeah, okay, but so that's just using your managerial talents to go, I understand that we can get this person back to a peak on this one occasion against this one opponent and against this particular individual on that team or doing a particular role. That's just good management too, but there is a bit where you're like cutting people, which he seems to have done along the way here. There are players who don't make it back the next year who were key members of the team in previous seasons.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I'm obviously less of a cold man. I'm not cold enough to potentially make it into county management. I just think that those two things could potentially get confused. The idea of what actually is form and what actually is somebody who will actually make it on a big day.
Just coming up to 10 minutes past 8, have you got one more final story for us?
Yeah, let's just mention Guardiola's comments. Like, fueling talk of unbelievable City quadruple, almost. It's Miguel Delaney's piece this morning. He's added the word almost into his quotes about it being impossible to win a quadruple this season. And he repeated himself saying almost. He describes it a miracle that his players have stayed in contention this long. And to be fair, Miguel does point out that this isn't quite true. And that's even before you get into the fact that they're the most lavishly funded state project in the whole history of football, or that two teams in recent history have gone further. So the other two times this has happened was Chelsea, who were still in with a chance of winning a quadruple up until May the 1st in 2007. They ended up with both domestic cups on that occasion. And Manchester United went all the way until April 19th in 2009. They ended up with the League Cup and the Premier League. But according to Miguel here, sources close to the camp say they're pretty confident that they can go all the way here, that the quadruple is nothing to be sniffed at. It's nothing to be referred to as impossible. Like, the idea that he slipped in that word almost impossible is actually probably being generous to their opposition. Well, Manchester City quietly are extremely confident.
Yeah, of course they are. Well, they've got to beat Watford and they've got to win out in the league, and like, none of these are difficult to see them doing at this stage. Okay, so even if they draw with Manchester United, the likelihood is that Liverpool are going to draw some more points, so they can afford one slip up and still potentially probably win the league given their goal difference. They're going to beat Watford in the final, you would expect, because they're a vastly superior team to Watford, and that's three of your four. So then it's just the Champions League that they have left. Like,
and lads, it's Spurs.
I mean, you know, in a new stadium where they're a bit freaked out,
and they've got, I don't want to use a cliche, but the Kevin De Bruyne injury has allowed them to pace their season nicely, where he comes back into fitness and now he's coming back into form.
And a lot of their players have actually, the squad is so deep that actually those injuries have helped them. Alright, that's it for your papers this morning. Now, we're talking football with Graham Hunter next, but on yesterday's Sunday paper review, our panel got talking about a potential exodus at Manchester United this summer. Have a look.
And this is an interesting story as well. It seems like there is a serious exodus about to happen at Manchester United. It's their front page story on the Sunday Times. Man United stars make summer exit plans. And this is Duncan Castles. So it seems that a growing number of Manchester United's key players are considering leaving in the summer. A seven-strong group that includes Paul Pogba and David De Gea are being tempted, especially with Champions League football looking less likely. So Pogba, it seems, is headed for Zinedine Zidane and Real Madrid. De Gea has been targeted by Madrid as well as PSG and Juventus. He's unhappy that they won't make him their highest paid player. So De Gea is free to sign a pre-contract with all of those suitors in 9 months' time. Next January, he's free to sign a contract elsewhere at the age of 28. Lukaku, it seems, is very open about his future, is the quote from the agent there. United are going to lose Ander Herrera. He's agreed a deal with PSG. Juan Mata is out of contract at the end of the season and seems to be going to Barcelona. And Eric Bailly is unhappy with his playing time. While finally, Alexis Sanchez understood to regret his January 2018 decision to move to Old Trafford rather than Man City. So there you go. Over to you, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Is it that big a deal if five of those seven go? Really, once you keep De Gea, everything's okay, right?
I'm still not sold on the idea that getting rid of Paul Pogba is the best course of action. Like, just in terms purely of the talents that he possesses. Like, of course I'm starting to think that the poisonous impact he's having around the club perhaps wasn't that exaggerated by Jose Mourinho or certainly in his suggestions. I don't know. Like, I know we've got Graham Hunter on the line, but we'll come back to this. I'm still not sold.
Let's start with it. Because a lot of those Man United players, Graham, we were talking about the front page story in yesterday's Sunday Times, which listed off seven Man United players who might not be at the club after the summer. De Gea is free to sign a pre-contract, according to the Sunday Times, from next January. You've got Pogba, then Bailly, Lukaku, Juan Mata, Alexis Sanchez, and there's one that I'm forgetting, but you get the picture. There's a massive potential summer turnaround, and I think with the exception of De Gea, they're going to get good money for most of the rest of them, and actually it'll then be Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's team and his club and his ethos and his belief system and his players.
Lads, you know me over now, what are we, 17 years?
17.
I'm not an obstreperous, bullshit, pedantic idiot, however. Assuming that mantle just for the moment, what the hell? Absolutely what the hell? What do you think, not you guys, Sunday Times, what do you think United fans are thinking about right now? They're thinking about Barcelona. They're thinking about the Champions League. They're thinking about if they perform with the resolution that they did against Paris Saint-Germain, not the football tactics, they might get the Champions League semi-final. What are they thinking about? They're thinking about keeping Chelsea and Arsenal off their backs and ensuring that their top four, top three even, which was firmly within their grasp until recent results, it's now not impossible. Top four. And United fans, and they count because they're the ones that you are broadcasting to, the Sunday Times are writing to, are thinking now, today, tomorrow, Wednesday, next Tuesday, where will Chelsea, where will Spurs, where will Arsenal trip up? These things you've reported on, the reality, I accept. But like, if you want to skip ahead of the most important 8 weeks United have had since Ferguson retired, then the thing to start with is that the club are looking for a director of football. It's my understanding that Ed Woodward understands now that as good as he is at the package of things that brought him to the head of the club, that the football side of things, he is now accepting it, not his 40, it's not even his 38 or 39.
Hey.
So the changes that you've talked about begin there. And, you know, I'm not deliberately being a Victor Meldrew, but, you know, you're football people. It's a football station. You know, by Wednesday, Old Trafford will be hosting the chance to see if they can stick one on the jaw of the Spanish champions elect and make the Camp Nou return leg 6 days later easier. I think these are the things that preoccupy rather than how quickly they can get rid of Alexis. And also, listen, my little parcel of information for you now that you've raised that subject is that while De Gea and the club haven't agreed the sum of money, the club know that De Gea wants to stay, would prefer to stay. That he'll reject all other offers? No. But it is his absolute preference to stay on at United. And therefore, if United handle that negotiation well, you're talking about detail, not wrestling somebody back who doesn't want to be there.
Yeah, I think that's a fairly obvious thing, and you can see it on both sides, his level of performance, the money they have, and the cost of replacement, all of the things, whatever it costs to keep David De Gea playing at this level, lock him in, make him a career lifetimer, let him retire as a Man United player, and you've got one of the best goalkeepers in the world for the next decade. It's like, it makes absolute sense, irrespective. Otherwise, you're paying 80 million quid in a transfer fee. You might as well just give him that 80 million quid and not worry about it. To go back to the game, obviously, Barcelona came through a tricky game against Atleti on Saturday evening where they had a numerical advantage for 60-odd minutes almost, maybe a bit less. What lessons are we to draw from these games? And is there ever any... because of the proximity to a big game, sometimes we might invest too much in what's happened. But at the same time, there must be some indication of how we expect them to perform at Old Trafford on Wednesday night.
Well, if so, then, you know, you would have taken heart. I spoke to Michael Carrick on Saturday night. He was there with Mick Phelan and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, both of whom were a little bit more in vision. But the three of them were able to go and assess properly the way that Barcelona were playing. I think they'll have gone away heartened. None of them didn't understand how clever Busquets is on the ball if you give him time. None of them learned something new about Gerard Piqué or about Ter Stegen or Messi. What the food for thought that they've been given, genuinely, lads, is that while Atleti played as good a game, either with Costa or without Costa, as they played all season, that was their elite performance all season, including the 2-0 win over Juventus in the Champions League at home at Metropolitano. Indeed, I was co-commentating with Steve Archibald, and his point of view was that was redolent of the first 4 or 5 Simeone years. Elite in positioning, confidence. So, okay, I've made my case about Atleti that they were superb. And therefore, you mark Barca out of 10 or 20 or 100, however you want, based on how their opponents allowed them to play, how clever their opponents were about damaging Barcelona in the areas that they don't like being damaged. Still, having said all that, Ger, Barcelona were out of personality. It wasn't like the 4-4 draw at Villarreal, where the spine of the team was missing. And you put it down to the fact there in the Madrigal in midweek that Umtiti was short of match practice. Longley didn't like not having Piqué next to him. Rakitic wasn't protecting Busquets. Messi wasn't on up front. As soon as you begin to put that together and you admit that Barcelona scored 2 goals, there was one absolutely extraordinary Oblak save, one-on-one from Suarez, a good save, one-on-one from Coutinho, and Alba hit the post. If you simply want to look at the stats, which all of us are taught not to do, particularly in answer to a type of question you posed, you could come away thinking, well, Barcelona were at their normal level and Atleti just did a very good job of staunching them. Not so. There was a bit of football personality missing at the weekend. And there the food for thought for Phelan and Solskjaer and Carrick is, did we see a blip? Was there a slight hint of nervousness about this is genuinely the final step, we win this and it's the title? Or is there a dip? Is there a dip anything like akin to the thrashing in Paris, the thrashing in Rome, the hammering in Turin against Juventus over the last 4 years in the Champions League? Are those things coming? That's what Manchester United need to test. I don't think it's quite that bad. I do think Barcelona were relatively poor in the things that make them different, that separate them from English Premier League teams. I think those things were absent at the weekend, and they can't afford to be absent midweek. two things to say. Vidal will be back. He would have played at the weekend. I think he might play at Old Trafford. And while Dembele's not fit to start, I think he'll be in the travelling squad. So there'll be minor adjustments. There'll be different things available to Valverde, who's proving a very good coach in situations like this, where he has to unpick a team, pick his team correctly, and generally understand how to manage a match.
Given the quality of the team that Barcelona have and the players and the nous that they have, ordinarily I would expect there to be far more people making the case for them to win this competition at this point, given who's gone from the tournament and given the other teams and just the ghosts that all of them have who are still left in the competition. And yet nobody is really standing on the table and banging it, going, this is Barcelona's to win this year and they've got to do it.
Yeah, you're right. And I think it's justified that nobody's doing that, because I don't see them anything. At their very best, they're still the best. Manchester City included, I'm sorry. At Barcelona's very best, this, let's say this 14-man squad, if they're all playing at their peak at this stage of the season, how many teams are, they're the best team left in the competition. Not only because they're extremely good, but they're brutally determined. We've heard little things from Pep. Pep got hammered in autumn, didn't he, by sitting in a press conference saying about Manchester City, this is still a club where people don't automatically demand every day that you win the Champions League. And he introduced that theme. People thought it was just a little bit of camouflage. Don't worry, but we'll sneak up behind everybody. No, he meant it. That the environment that he knows exists at Real Madrid, at Juventus too now, and at Barcelona, which is win the Champions League, win the Champions League, is an important driving factor, and Barcelona have it. Piqué, Busquets, Rakitic, Messi, they've all spoken about their utter determination to win this competition again this year. But first of all, Gerard, when you see a grand old champion taking challengers, punches to the jaw, and you find out the jaw is glass, as repeatedly as we have done, Juventus, Paris Saint-Germain, Roma, people are right to say, well, is it any different this year? And I think that there is, the Barcelona have moved back towards the pack. And they are very good, they're very organised, and Valverde has made them a better functioning 11, less reliant on the positional and possession play that made Barcelona stand out since Rijkaard took over, but particularly in the Guardiola years. It's not the same football, and therefore they're not as outrageously different on form, but they have Messi and Suarez and Alba, and those partnerships with Messi, Alba and Suarez particularly, are extraordinary, and therefore if Barca are absolutely on form, they win this tie and the next one in the final. If they're not, then yeah, they're close to the pack.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit earlier on about the Guardiola happiness, to just insert the whole notion of the quadruple into the conversation.
Yeah, like I'm not sure what you think of this, Graham, but it certainly seems, from just reading around reports this morning, that there are sounds from Manchester City that they're quietly confident of making this quadruple happen. Like, I do wonder if Pep is the type of guy who actually thrives under that. In fact, I know he definitely is, but is Manchester City the type of squad that can thrive under that? That expectation that they should go close to a quadruple, because that is a humongous expectation.
Yeah, I really like your point. I think that Pep does thrive at maximum. He's not inhuman. You know, we've seen moments of burnout before, and therefore I don't think, if you were asking me after two or three seasons of really chasing quadruples hard, that we'd be having the same conversation, because he's not immune to pressure. But he definitely does feed on having to work hard, having to demand from the players every minute of every day. I interviewed Busquets on Thursday, and I talked about how rare it was to have heard Pep Guardiola talking after the Wembley final against Manchester United about how brilliant the football was, that the football for about 35 minutes was perfection, all he'd ever aimed for. And I said, listen, Pep's very demanding. You never hear that from him. And Busquets was like, listen, we became accustomed to the fact that we knew we'd played brilliantly, and he would tell us we weren't even the better side on the pitch, simply to try and keep us hungry. And therefore, taking that and, you know, extrapolating to what you're talking about, the fact that Pep demands quadruple level performance from his players all season, every season, is aided by the fact that the players now buy into it. That's the thing I think that you've elicited from the atmosphere at City's training ground, at the academy, that when you're as demanding as Guardiola is, but the players all know that there really are four trophies within touching distance, then what you get is a much quicker transition from the players every, well, Mendy apart, because man has to disco dance. And a man's got a disco dance. Man's got a disco dance. Sharp or not sharp. But the rest of them are, I think, clicking into that mindset that you've said, that if they give elite performances day in, day out, not match in, match out, between now and the end of the season, then they might have an historic four trophy haul. Yeah, I think the atmosphere is good there. Squad-wise, I'll be shorter. I still have my doubts. I genuinely don't think that City are ahead of the pack in the Champions League, and I've tipped Liverpool to win the title. So between the title of the Premier League, one of those goes stops the quadruple. I genuinely think Liverpool win every game between now and the end of the season. And I think that this amen corner, if you forgive the Masters comparison, that's coming up for City, with Palace and Spurs and United and Spurs and Spurs and Spurs. How, is it 6 or 7 games against Spurs?
12.
I think you drop a point there.
Graham, good stuff. Thanks a million.
All right, fellas.
Enjoy the week. It's Graham Hunter joining us here this morning to talk to us about some big Champions League, some hot, hot, hot Champions League action coming your way. So there is a game tonight. Chelsea playing West Ham, completely unheralded in the Premier League. It's Liverpool Porto tomorrow at 8, Spurs Man City, and then on Wednesday, as we were talking about, at Old Trafford, Man United against Barcelona and Ajax against Juventus.
The Declan Rice derby tonight, of course. I actually agree with your point there about the Champions League contenders or pretenders, that there is severe kind of evidence of baggage around all these teams that are selected.
Yeah,
like there really is.
They've all shat the bed at some point over the last couple of years.
And it's the interesting point that he makes there about Busquets. Like,
this is the one year, by the way, if Atletico Madrid were left, you'd be like, oh, this is their chance. They're going to win it this year.
Yeah, but they're not.
I know.
Like, because their ghosts have also crept up on them and stabbed them in the back. Like, if there's a chance that everybody, you can make a case for all of these teams bottling it at one case or at one point or another here. But like, you do wonder, like when he brings up those Busquets quotes post Wembley, the idea that Pep would still be giving out to them after near perfect performances. It's very simple psychology. He's clearly a stick man rather than a carrot man, and that obviously worked on those Barcelona players. What are you laughing at?
Stick man.
He's an actual human being. I don't know. That was peak Barcelona. That was as good a football team as I've seen in my lifetime. Is that part of it? Like, is that the most harshly treated those Barcelona players have ever been treated under Pep Guardiola? Time will probably tell.
Nobody can come in afterwards and treat them as harsh and have any respect, because it's like, we were the greatest team of all time.
That's
so
true.
I think it's fair enough that that was his, but it didn't work for him. It was unsustainable. He should still be at Barcelona. They should have won 3 more Champions Leagues under Guardiola. He should have stayed there. He should have been able to calmly re-energise himself and that team. Like, that's the lost rings, is the Guardiola at Barcelona, when actually he was in New York, Munich and in Manchester. When he is 70, he's going to look back and go, I walked out in the best team of all time at the peak of their powers, just having reached football perfection.
Unless...
Why did I do that? I had Leo Messi. I had the greatest player of all time on my team, and I walked away to learn English in New York for a year and to work with those Germans who hated me. Why did I do it? For what?
Well, I think there's a chance that Barcelona fans will be asking themselves that as well.
Everybody's going to be asking themselves that.
As much as it's been relatively easy for Manchester City to learn and improve because of the bottomless pit of cash that they have learned and they have improved. They have looked at failings of managers and sporting directors and scouts and recruiters all around the world and applied it to their own club. They've run their club really well. Granted, as I said, the caveat being that they could do it with a bottomless pit of cash. They will study how Pep finished at Barcelona, and they will say to themselves, how do we make sure this does not happen at our club?
It doesn't matter anymore.
I know, because they don't have Lionel Messi, and they never will have a team potentially as gifted as that.
But Guardiola's missed the greatest opportunity he's missed the opportunity to fulfil his destiny, really.
Because it has to be at Barcelona. But he can get the next best thing.
There's always going to be, he's going to be the unhappy billionaire. He's going to be like, that thing we had, it was perfection, and politics got in the way. Politics and ego and bullshit got in the way. We could talk about this again, because it's never going to go away. It turns out it is the ghost that will haunt. Even if Guardiola wins 3 Champions Leagues with Manchester City, will he be fulfilled the way he would have been if he'd won 5, which he should have done with that team?
No, of course not, because it's Barcelona. There is no way you can replicate that unique scenario anywhere else because of his background. But on a purely cold statistical success level, he might just be able to do so. But it's into the future.
The stats, no problem. So he can match the stats. Does he love stats? Do the stats keep him warm at night in his silk sheets?
No, he's... He'd rather write 50 beautiful poems than have £50 billion in his bank account.
So who called him Snowflakey? Jim Beglin?
Jim Beglin, yeah. On NBC's coverage yesterday. I was out and about. That's why I wasn't watching it on actual television. Let's put it down to that.
They will knock on your door and no one will be able to save you. That's what's coming. They will knock on your door and you are going to prison. Kevin Caban joined Nathan in Goodison Park yesterday for our live coverage of Everton against Arsenal. No references to Snowflakey here. After the game, they got talk in the title race. Have a look.
This time next week, we're going to be half a mile across Stanley Park for Liverpool against Chelsea.
Yeah.
More twists in the title race this week with Liverpool retaking top spot. We were talking with Gary Breen yesterday about the last month and what Manchester City have had, which is very comfortable, straightforward victories,
yeah,
and Liverpool, the fight of their lives to keep this going. Is there a way that that makes Liverpool more battle-hardened for the next month, that Manchester City could find themselves caught out when they go to Selhurst Park next Sunday, that it's almost been too easy for them? Or is that possible?
They certainly have a lot more control in games, don't they, City? I think it's an easy thing to say, but that's certainly the way that it is for them. I don't know. It's a difficult one to answer, is that, because who knows? Who knows how it's going to be? I'm watching Liverpool, seriously thinking in my head, they cannot continue to win the way that they're winning games. They were outplayed for long spells, particularly in the first half against Southampton. They should have been probably a couple of goals down, but they're staying in games. They've got the outstanding player in the Premier League, I think, in Van Dijk defensively, and he's almost covering up a lot of the errors that's been made by a number of his teammates defensively. So they are battle hardened. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't disagree with it. I couldn't disagree with that logic, but it just, something in my head thinks City will win it because of how much more control they have over games in Liverpool.
You've got a big game Friday, Kev. You're playing in the Sean Cox fundraiser. Do you want to do a couple of laps here and get yourself ready?
No, if I did one lap of this pitch, I'd be knackered, I'd be gone. Hopefully I'll get...
Don't embarrass us now,
25 minutes in the game. When I was playing down in the Liam Miller game down in Cork, I think...
Yeah, it was embarrassing.
It was embarrassing, yeah. And I realised that when you run around for 5 minutes, I was knackered, I was gone. And that was the case with everyone. I think we're on a bit of a smaller pitch this time, which is going to help. That's certainly going to help us. I don't know. I'll maybe just pass it and move it in the middle of the park. Bendy lad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like that?
Just like that, yeah.
All right, well, best of luck with it, Kev.
Yeah.
Best of luck with it. We'll be watching closely. We cannot wait. So, good win for Everton. We're back next week. Anfield, Liverpool, Chelsea.
Good stuff, lads. Thanks for that. Let's head over to New York. Will's in studio.
Morning.
Looking a bit bleary-eyed. What's your name, Will?
It's Will O'Callaghan, I think, still.
Yeah. Darren is broadcasting live from New York City. Ah, Darren, nice hotel.
That's 5-star.
Mm.
Good morning. Good evening.
How are you?
It's good morning here too. A bit like Will, a bit bleary-eyed, but still on the high of life that was my first experience at WrestleMania, off the childhood bucket list.
So tell us a little bit about what happened. You, it's in MetLife Stadium, which is the Giants and Jets stadium out in Jersey, is that right?
Yeah, and Jersey seems like a million miles away. It took about 2.5 hours to get home, 2 trains and a taxi. Bit of an ordeal. After a 7-hour show, it was a rough trip back, but it was a really, really exciting day, really cool. Probably lived up to the hype. It's pomp, it's pageantry. I found myself at one stage, instead of watching the pre-show, engaged in a Twitter argument with someone about whether or not wrestling was a sport. Spoiler alert, it's not a sport. No one over the age of 12 thinks it's a sport. You are not telling a wrestling fan anything new when you say, it's not real, it's predetermined. So I gave up on that and decided to just enjoy the show. And it was a really, really enjoyable show for a load of reasons. Chief among them being that Becky Lynch walked out the big winner.
Yeah, so this is WrestleMania 35. She's the first, second ever non-Yank to main event. Is that right?
Correct. Everyone has been American or Canadian for the previous main events. Her, Becky Lynch, and Andre the Giant, the only two not from North America, and the USA and Canada, to actually make the main event. So it's a pretty sizable achievement. And the fact that she actually made it to the main event is incredible when you think that the way women were treated and regarded in wrestling was as sideshow and as titillation for juvenile adults for the best part of 2 decades. They were not taken seriously. They were not there to have matches. They were there to keep teenagers involved, interested, and aroused in the product. So to actually be part of a sea change where she's helped this generation of female wrestlers, have helped herald an age where they're not only seen as equals to men, but they're seen as bigger draws. Like they were the table toppers. They were the big names on the card. They were the match everyone wanted to see. And with some really big global superstars in that world, it's a massive achievement.
So she beats Ronda Rousey. Explain what happens in WrestleMania, main event. So how many times is she in the ring? How long is she out there for? Who's she up against? What does that work? How does that work?
Yeah, it was a triple threat match. It was Ronda Rousey, who obviously came in last year to huge fanfare. She's crossed over from UFC. Really, really adapted well to it. A lot of people thought she would be the kind of person who would appear maybe 7 or 8 times a year. She hasn't gone full time. She's not on the road 250 days a year, but she is competing pretty regularly and has taken to it really well. So it was Becky versus Charlotte Flair, who's the daughter of 16-time champion Ric Flair, and Ronda Rousey. And it was basically two belts on the line that have two competing brands, a Raw brand which broadcast live on Monday night, and a SmackDown brand which has just signed a $4 billion deal with Fox to broadcast their product. So the two women titles were on the line. It was winner takes all. It was Becky, Ronda, and Charlotte. No disqualification. They went at it. It was a stiff enough match. It's kind of been building in a way where Ronda's gone off script and broken the fourth wall by saying, I'm not going to play by your fake rules anymore and your fake sport. I'm a real fighter and I'm going to beat the holy hell out of all of you. So there's that lovely line that's blurred sometimes where you're not quite sure if she is going to hurt the person she's in the ring with. And it was a pretty stiff match. It was a decent match. A lot of people pretty happy with the way it turned out. It was a solid enough affair. The only thing was the end seemed a little bit screwy in the fact that it kind of came out of nowhere. Usually, like, the whole point of wrestling is to tell a story. You get a story done in 15-20 minutes, so a beginning, a middle, and an end. And fans should be able to see the end coming. That's the idea, that they will take you on a journey up and down with your emotions and eventually give you a payoff of a winner or a loser. But the end kind of came a bit abrupt and caught people off guard. But for the most part, the fans were usually invested in what was happening. 82,000 people there in the MetLife, a new attendance record for a WWE event at that stadium.
Well, you were watching on TV?
I was, yeah. I agree with Darren at the end. I mean, obviously, Becky Lynch, this has been kind of a 6-7 month build that she was going to go win both titles. There was no doubt about what the result was going to be last night. But then the way they finished it was that they kept Ronda Rousey looking reasonably strong at the end. I'm guessing this is not the end of her time with WWE. She goes, it looks like she's going to get the win. She uses her finishing maneuver. It's reversed by Becky Lynch into a bit of a surprise win. It's the kind of thing you expect the bad guy or the bad woman going into the match to do at the end, as opposed to wanting to put over your biggest star in the company. But as Darren says, you know, it's been quite remarkable that Becky Lynch, you know, originally from Limerick but grew up in Dublin, has become the top merchandise seller for WWE, effectively, which many people might remember Stone Cold Steve Austin's character, where effectively, I'm the man, I'll run over everybody in the company and no one's going to hold me back. This is the character that she's had going into this, and she's become the biggest name in wrestling right now. And the man who trained her as well, Finn Balor, he went and won the Intercontinental title last night as well. So we had two Irish successes on the one card.
Yeah, you were interviewing Sheamus on our social channels last night as well. He was in a tag team, I think.
Yeah, he was unsuccessful in it, but like, it's a long card. That's probably the hardest part about it, is you can get quite tired, and the main event probably suffered from that bit of fatigue. Like, it was midnight before the entrances were finished and they got on, so the fans were probably a bit too tired for it, because they had, I don't know, maybe 9 or 10 matches across the pre-show. So it was a long old build. By the time the Sheamus match came, you're kind of mid-card. Thought maybe he could have got a 6th title reign as tag team, which would put them 2 within the record held by the Dudley boys. It's a really positive time, I suppose, overall, when you look at have 3 Irish people on the biggest event in professional wrestling is staggering. And the fact that Finn Balor was able to leave with the Intercontinental title, which would be seen as the secondary title to the main belt, it would generally be a way of priming people for the big time. It's like a workhorse title. It's a way of rewarding your mid-carders. People like Stone Cold Steve Austin have held it, Bret Hart, his brother Owen Hart, The Rock, everyone has held that belt. So he got it. He got a big win in WrestleMania. He went on second last. He was incredibly high up the card. I mean, he was he went on after Brock Lesnar. He went on after John Cena. He was really, really close to that main event, which was headlined by Becky and won by Becky. And I think her story before this is more interesting than where she is now, because she's someone that retired in 07 on doctor's advice. She had, like, the doctor feared she had brain damage. She damaged her eighth cranial nerve after a really bad concussion and basically said, don't do this. She went, she was an air hostess for a while. She was a stunt woman on the Vikings movie and then did some wrestling stuff to prepare for stunts. So she would do the wrestling cardio and training to prepare for the physical stuff of the stunts. And then that came a conversation of, why don't you go back? You're cleared by your doctors to go back and try this again. And she was very hesitant to do it. But when she did about 5 years ago, it started on a path which ended with her now being anointed as the face of a billion-dollar company, which, okay, someone has decided. It's predetermined. She didn't actually win a title. She was given a title, but she was also given the responsibility of being a face of that company.
Well, so, you know, that, I mean, that's the question I think a lot of people are asking. What does this mean for her on a personal financial level? Like, is there prize money? Is there just a better contract? Is it, does she get a share of any of the merchandise that they're selling, or is she still the same employee and the same salary and wages that she was before this all happened?
No, it would definitely be a game changer. There would be pay-per-view bonuses and structures, and one or two wrestlers have actually left over the years because the bonus and pay-per-view structure wasn't what it should have been. The WWE invented their own network, which kind of restructured how they awarded the pay-per-view bonuses, because not all of the shows were then had the same pay-per-view buy rates if people could sign up for $12 a month or €13 a month and do it. So she will become a big star of this. Like, she's breakout. She's on every poster I've seen in the city of New York. She is going to be massive. Obviously, being at the top of the card, drawing money, you get a cut of the merch sales. The fact that she's the biggest merch seller in the company at the moment means that obviously she gets a cut of that. I'm not sure what the actual percentage is. It might be around one or two, but still pretty sizable if she shifts a million t-shirts. And she will definitely benefit from being up near the top of the card, which she is going to be for the next few months, you would imagine. The way in which she defeated Ronda made Ronda look really strong. It wasn't a case of, it wasn't a clean win. It wasn't middle of the ring, three count. Ronda was beaten fair and square. It was quite messy as a finish where it looked like Ronda just kicked out. So everyone comes out of it looking pretty well. Becky is obviously the feel-good story. It made sense to give her this run because the fans are desperate to see her do well. But the fact that Ronda now is probably going to go into a pretty lucrative feud with Becky over the next few months, that we'll see both of them near the top of the card, I would imagine.
An expectation, you would imagine, as well. Like, 20 years ago, wrestling was at a much better place in terms of popularity, but money-wise, WWE have never had more money than they have. Ironically enough, they've signed a big deal with the Saudis to go over multiple times a year, which is going to net them a lot of money. And interestingly, they didn't let their women wrestle on the last time that they went to Saudi Arabia. So the next time they go, given that Becky Lynch is the person that they're pushing, it's going to be interesting to see whether women are allowed to perform there. And the Fox deal, as Darren mentioned, $4 billion. You would imagine if you're Becky Lynch and you're going into the next contract renegotiation, she's definitely going to be on SmackDown for Fox. You would think that she's asking for a lot of coin to stay around.
Yeah, okay. Anything else that you took away? Different, I presume, very different experience from being the, you get to fall asleep for a little bit. So
I was at WrestleMania 18 back in 2002, and it was a much shorter card than what we saw last night. I think it was about 3.5 to 4 hours, which is a lot more palatable even when you are in bed than when you're trying to watch 7 hours on your phone to try and catch up with things. And realistically, I think the main event did suffer a lot because people were just remarkably tired at that point. There's only so much energy a live crowd can actually give, and when you've been sitting down in your chair for that long, you've probably had a few beers, naturally the energy drops a little bit. I thought the main event was pretty okay. I mean, I'm kind of with Darren on the finish of it. Outside of that, it was a very mixed bag. There was a lot of kind of results that won't have pleased the fans along the way. Kurt Angle, who was a big star of the show, ended up going out against Baron Corbin. Triple H retired Batista on the card as well. Not kind of the expectation or the happy moments, but the big titles all went to faces, the kind of people that are meant to be cheered by the crowd, with Seth Rollins winning the Raw title, Finn Balor winning the Intercontinental, and Kofi Kingston winning the SmackDown. So I think on reflection, probably a happy enough night for those who attended. And for WWE, when you talk about the money as well, they made $13.6 million on the gate last night in ticket sales alone, based on the 83,000. So while wrestling mightn't be the most popular, it's in an extremely healthy place financially.
Yeah. Is the atmosphere amazing, Darren? Like, you said it was a bucket list thing. Obviously, you've been a fan, you wanted to go, you got the opportunity to go. In terms of it being a proper bucket list item, did it live up to your expectations?
It lived up to mine, but I wouldn't recommend a non-fan went to WrestleMania, because it is an ordeal. Like, even if you're invested and want to see it, it goes on for an obnoxious amount of time and you're just literally exhausted by the end of it. There are better ways to sample it and see if you would like it. I mean, I get that not everyone's going to like it, and they're perfectly entitled not to like it. I would always compare it with like Game of Thrones. People always say, you know, wrestling's not real. Yeah, but Game of Thrones isn't either, and I like that. I don't believe there's dragons or frostwalkers. So I think
frosty
people have
monsters,
to
monsters, Darren.
Frosty monsters. Sorry, Will. That's your phrase. People get this perverse pleasure in telling people that wrestling isn't real, and I can never really understand it. I never understand why someone thinks that they're the first person to tell an adult that what you are watching is not real. It's still real to me, damn it. It was on the bucket list, and it was really, really enjoyable. It was a lot of fun. I mean, it starts with Hulk Hogan, who is just not a wrestling icon, but a genuine cultural icon. Like, everyone in the world knows who Hulk Hogan is, and at that stage, it just can't really go downhill. It was a lot of fun. Probably a little bit too long, but I would definitely go again.
Darren, good stuff. Thanks a million. Safe home. Enjoy the rest of your time in New York.
Cheers, guys.
Sam, our man in New York at WrestleMania, talking to us about his bucket list item being cleared. You were at the Westmeath Leash game in Croker yesterday.
We'll
talk to you
then,
a little bit
later
on, because we can't go from the sublime to... which would
the more sublime, the reasonably ridiculous game.
Okay, so we'll talk to you a little bit later on about that. Thanks very much for that, Will. Just want to talk to you about this. So Davey Russell obviously guided Tiger Roll to a sensational back-to-back Grand National title on Saturday afternoon. Yesterday he joined Joe on Off the Ball on Sunday for a 20-minute chat. You can watch and listen back to that full thing over at offtheball.com. Here is the final fence of the 2019 Grand National, and then Davey on the pressure that he felt.
Coming to the elbow from in second position, Magic of Light, Rath Vinden, one for Arthur, staying on into fourth. It's been 45 years, and now Davey Russell shakes up Tiger Roll. Magic of Light in second, Rath Vinden in third, Walk in the Mill is back in fourth. Tiger Roll is remarkable. He comes up towards the winning line under Davey Russell to win his second Randox Health Grand National. Tiger Roll joins the greats and beats Magic of Light a massive run.
Does the favourites tag weigh in any way on you? Do you feel any extra responsibility or pressure when you're 4-1 favourite?
Yeah, not so much the favourite side of it. That doesn't bother me too much in the Grand National. It's a little bit irrelevant because obviously 150-1 shot can win it. But I felt a shocking amount of pressure this year because of the horse that it was. And so much can go wrong in a Grand National, like obviously the rain, which is uncontrollable, but people just didn't want to hear it. They wanted, there was going to be no other winner of the Grand National, only Tiger Roll in the majority, and I felt a lot of pressure that way, that maybe a guy that was going to have his one and only bet in a race, he was going to have it on Tiger Roll, you know. And bookies were playing it as if it was the biggest loss they'll ever have in a Grand National. And to be fair to the bookies, you know, they play a part in our sport. But this year is just, it was one for the housewife and for the taxi driver and for anybody that got up yesterday morning and to pick a horse. They kind of, you know, they were picking Tiger Roll because everybody felt he was going to win it, you know. Everybody felt he was going to win it.
All right, Tom Malone is here to talk to us a bit about the weekend. Well, to talk to us really about today. Let's go with the National first, because did you say you were...
Yeah, well, he received a hero's welcome in Summerhill. Came to me yesterday, did Tiger Roll. It was phenomenal. Became the first back-to-back winner, obviously, of the race since Red Roma in 1974.
We watched you live. It's you going mad.
I did. I definitely lost control a little bit. But look, this horse is just one of the most incredible horses I've ever seen.
Why?
He's just so non-traditional in that when you think of a Grand National horse, you should think of a big, massive, plodding, staying chaser. And I use the analogy, it's like the difference between looking at a rugby player and a football player physically. He's less than 16 hands. A hand is a height in a horse, basically. So he's shorter than 160 centimetres tall at his withers, which is the bottom of his neck. And he's just a really nimble, efficient jumper, which is completely different from the sort of expected norm that a horse is a big lump of a staying chaser who just lobs away. Obviously the Grand National is different because you do need an element of tactical pace to stick with it in the early, you know, the early parts of the race. But his performance is absolutely incredible. After the race, Michael O'Leary suggested that he'd probably be retired after Cheltenham next year.
Yeah, but I don't know. He was like, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, you know, we'll see how he is after Cheltenham next year, because like the chance to win three in a row is the greatest.
Is absolutely incredible. Also, he'll only be 10.
Yeah, that's another thing. You know, now he will have to carry a big lump of weight. There's no doubt about that. He'll have 11 stone 10 is the top weight you're going to have to carry in a national, which isn't that much. I mean, it's only 5 pounds more than he carried at the weekend, but it's more the gap between him and the second top weight. You know, Annabelle Fly ran an absolute crack run on Saturday to finish fifth of top weight. That was only 3 weeks after placing a Gold Cup. He probably needs a little bit softer ground, but the kind of horse is going to be so classy. It's going to get into this race next year if Tiger Roll is running and runs in top weight. I mean, you're going to have
just
to
explain that, will you? Because that's
Horses have a basically a numerical value put on what the handicapper assesses their ability is. So he's going to be top weight, and he's probably going to have a mark around about 160. So in theoretical terms, every number represents a pound. So a horse that's then rated 150 would have to carry 10 pounds less weight than him. So, you know, theoretically, he could be in the mid 160s. So you're talking about, like, say that the Paddy Power Chase at Leopardstown, which is generally a recognised trial, right? But that's a handicap. So the best horse in that will be rated 150. So the best horse in that is going to carry a stone less, more than likely, than Tiger Roll come the Grand National next year, which is just... So to go and win the race, given those kind of terms, is it's kind of
almost impossible.
It's a very very big
sounds like the type of challenge Michael O'Leary would love.
Yeah,
that's the other side of it. Yeah,
not obviously impossible because Red Rum has done this before.
Well, he hasn't done three in a row, of course. But Red Rum, of course, last horse to do it, 73-74. Had a look back at some of the sports pages from 1974 because I got bored of this morning's sports pages at one point or another. So this was the 30th of March 1974 when Red Rum did it. The 1st of April then, 1974, was a Sunday. So we'll start with the Sunday Independent that morning. And their sports section led with Red Rum the Toast. You guys, a couple of other stories here. I always like looking at the other stories around this time. Croke Park being abused. Tour means vital dates lost. Justimus wins now for 2000. Let's zoom in on that Red Rum story. Tom McCormack writing from Aintree. Yeah. So this is Ginger McCain with a shock of ginger hair brushed back, beamed all over when confirming what he has been saying all the week, that his charge had only to stand up and avoid trouble to emulate Reynoldstown. I love that confidence. It's easy talking with confidence of a horse like this, but Red Rum has made himself, and it's 7 years to the day since he won here over five furlongs as a two-year-old. He's better than a good horse. He was great today, and he has been waiting his opportunity for Brian. Gets on with him so well. I'm delighted to be associated with Red Rum, who never makes you lose any sleep because everything goes so well with him. Would you believe it? Red Rum has raced more than 140 miles over fences, and we have had tremendous pleasure out of him. But I would like to think that this is his last race of the season, though we shall think over it. But he will certainly not go to take on the French in June, for there is nothing he likes better than to get out on summer grass. Let's move on to the Irish Press then, of course. This is the Monday morning.
So just make one other piece on that. Red Rum won over five furlongs as a two-year-old, and to go win a Grand National, that is just ridiculous stuff. Like, to win over five furlongs as a two-year-old and then to still go
sprinter,
sprint over the absolute minimum trip,
and he was only getting started as well.
Absolutely. Even to have a career where you can be successful on the flat and over jumps is phenomenal. Yeah. Also, by the way, in the interim years between his national wins, he was second both times as well.
Yeah, that's true. Actually,
first second first. Yeah. 5 years
ago. Well, 77 was the third.
Even to run in five nationals is a phenomenal achievement, let alone they'll go 1-1, 2-2, 1. Like.
And did the weights, I mean, the handicapping system hasn't changed in a millennium, so...
No, it's not. The difference between the Grand National and others is that the weights are framed very early. So those weights, and it is a compressed handicap as well, so horses will run off marks that they potentially wouldn't actually be.
Okay.
There is an element of discretion by the handicapper in assessing.
So they were like being nice to Red Rum after he won his first two to get him back in to give him another chance.
Possibly, but not too much.
The Irish Press then the Monday after, so this is 2 days after the Grand National, he's a tops. This is the headline with regards to Red Rum. That is Beryl McCain, who I presume is Ginger McCain's wife.
I would guess so, or
daughter perhaps, with Red Rum there. And we'll move on to the Irish Examiner then, of course, the same morning, 2 days after the National. This kind of gives a sense of the prominence that Red Rum was given on that Monday morning. You can see Cork beat All Stars in unfriendly, St Finbarr's power to four in a row, Cork home to Galway in All-Ireland, you've got a Nottingham card, you've got Plumpton, Carlisle runners, and then the very bottom right of the left-hand page, you've got great welcome for Red Rum, and we can zoom in on this particular story. Red Rum reported in fine fettle yesterday after his second Grand National victory at Aintree. Donald McCain said he has eaten up well and is as bright as a sixpence. The race does not appear to have taken too much out of him, and he is very well indeed. This great quote there at the bottom left says McCain, after Red Rum had eaten about 96 packets of polo mints and endless carrots, we just had him to lock the gates and allow him to rest. Those quotes back in the day are so good. He can't be given any more weight, says McCain. The weight hasn't stopped him this time, and I see no reason why it should stop him next time, providing the ground is right. In the circumstances, I think 10 to 1 is fairly generous. We'll move on then to the Irish Independent from the same morning. This kind of gives a sense of Red Rum's prominence. I guess the review, not as big as the preview, which is kind of understandable 2 days out, but we can get a bit of a closer look on this. Actually, let's go to the front of the Irish Independent, because I was looking, did Red Rum make the front page of the Irish Independent? Because back in the day, sports stories never used to make the front of the newspaper. It didn't, but a sports story did. Last of the big benders, says the headline here. Soccer storm over the high-jumping keeper. Let's take a look at this story. Athlone goalkeeper Mick O'Brien found a new way of stopping a game when his side were being beaten by 4-0 in yesterday's FAI Cup semi-final in Oriel Park. He ran out of his goal, and to the astonishment of the 6,000 crowd, he climbed up on the net on top of the goal and jumped on top of the crossbar until it broke. His action almost caused a riot. He was immediately sent off by the referee and was showered by beer cans as angry Finn Harp supporters booed him while he ran to the dressing room. He had broken the bar earlier in the game, but that time it was an accident. He swung on the bar as a Finn Harp's player shot over and the bar came tumbling down on top of him. After a 10-minute delay, the match resumed, but twice afterwards O'Brien tried to bring down the bar by swinging on it. Harp's manager Patsy McGowan was on the sidelines protesting, but the referee ordered him to sit down. Then sensationally, after Harp had scored their fourth goal, O'Brien climbed the net, jumped in the bar and did the job properly. He said afterwards that Mick got carried away. He was desperately disappointed in not reaching the final and just climbed up on the spur at the moment. He was very sorry afterwards and was almost crying in the dressing room. Unfortunately, we don't have a story that sensational to move Tiger Roll off the back pages this morning.
All right, Tom, have you got one story for us?
Well, obviously in the in football, Watford play Manchester City in the FA Cup final next month. The Hornets came from 2-0 down to beat Wolves 3-2 after extra time in that semi-final at Wembley. De La Feo scored twice coming off the bench as Watford reached their first final in 35 years. Javier Garcia was pretty impressed with his players.
When everything was lost, I think the team was able to show our character, our personality, our ambition, and believing until the end, we were able to win today.
Yeah, I mean, it's just going to be an incredible FA Cup final there. Looking forward to that. A huge day for Watford.
All right, Tom, good stuff. Let's move on. We're going to talk about, here's some Seamus Coleman, obviously. The Sean Cox fundraiser takes place at the Aviva at the weekend. One of the big supporters of it a whole way along has been Seamus Coleman. Here he is talking with Nathan about why. Have a look.
And just one last thing, there's a big day in Dublin on Friday with the Sean Cox fundraiser. Great news today that he's actually going to be able to attend the game. I know you met with the family, you've been a great, generous supporter of the foundation. It's obviously something that's very close to your heart.
It is, it's just, I got involved, I wanted to do something. He's, an Irish man. I just pictured him leaving Dublin Airport that morning to be excited to go to a football game like all people do, and to think that something like that can happen. I just, for some reason, it touched the spot, and I wanted to help. And then, at the training ground in Dublin, I met the mother and the son, and I wanted to do something again. And sometimes putting your name to things, it's not for any personal attention. It's to raise awareness for the cause, and I think I did that. And now with this game coming up, it'll be great, and if people can get behind it, because speaking to his wife, they are going to need some funding for his care, and should never happen. And I think Liverpool as a club have rallied around them brilliantly, and I hope that game goes great.
That's Seamus Coleman there. It was announced at New Talk Breakfast with Susan Keogh yesterday morning that Sean Cox will leave hospital for the very first time to attend this Friday's Ireland versus Liverpool Legends charity match in the Aviva Stadium. Huge crowd is expected, where a team of Liverpool Legends will take on a Republic of Ireland Legends team. Kenny Dalglish is the manager. Sander Westerveld, Robbie Fowler, Ian Rush, Steve McManaman playing for Liverpool. Mick McCarthy takes charge of Kenny Cunningham, Ray Houghton, Damien Duff and Niall Quinn, and maybe Kevin Kilbane, amongst others. Robbie Keane, John Aldridge, Jason McAteer and Phil Babb will get to play for both sides. The one time in your life that a half and half scarf is allowed. Tickets are available on Ticketmaster for the 7:45 kickoff. There'll be stuff beforehand as well. So that's this coming Friday night at the Aviva. It's for an amazing cause. Seamus Coleman obviously has shown tremendous support to the Cox family over the year and been a real leader on this as well. So well done to everybody involved. There's I know there's a dinner on the night before too, and it looks like most of the fundraising targets will be met, but there are still tickets available for the game, so go along, have a great time, and yeah, looking forward to that. Now let's move on. Rugby. Alan Quinlan is here. How are you?
Good morning.
It's an interesting weekend of rugby, right?
It was, yeah, and it's I suppose with three games to go, it's sometimes the Pro 14 after big European games or Six Nations kind of is lost a little bit, but it was a very significant weekend for various different reasons. Obviously
a 6-5 classic in Italy, for example.
Yeah, but you know what, it was
they're the games that actually stand teams in good stead.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, they didn't play that well, Connacht, and but to get that win was really significant, because Cardiff are breathing down their necks. I think they're Connacht are in third and Cardiff fourth. There's only 4 points separating them. So Munster did them a favour on Friday night by beating Cardiff, and then Connacht's getting the win themselves. So they go head to head next weekend in Galway, and that's
it's the perfect
a winner take all type,
isn't it?
Like, well, if Connacht win, they're guaranteed playoffs. They're guaranteed European rugby. It's huge, really. So the games of the weekend effectively were huge games, Ger. Ulster have put themselves under pressure. It was always tricky going to, you know, going away to Glasgow, and they're away to Edinburgh this week as well, so it makes it very difficult. And Edinburgh are breathing down their neck, along with Benetton are in third, but Edinburgh in fourth and 51 points, so Ulster kind of suffered a bit of a hangover after the previous week, which is difficult, and that's
they're not,
a challenge.
They don't have the squad depth just yet to be able to absorb a loss like that and come out the other side. You kind of feel like we're in that stage of Ulster's development where they need to add strength and depth, but they also need to get used to being competitive again.
Yeah, from where they were in the last couple of seasons, it's they show their capabilities in the quarterfinals against Leinster when they have a full deck to choose from. But as you say, it's probably that depth, and they're in real danger of possibly missing out, because they're on 54, Benetton on 52, and Edinburgh on 51. So away to Edinburgh is going to be tricky for them now at the weekend. They've got to win that one, because you know Edinburgh obviously go ahead of them if they beat them, and you know they've Leinster at home the following weekend, which are the last round of fixtures. Which
yeah.
We know Leinster already qualified, guaranteed home semi final. It'll be the week after Toulouse, so it'll be a week in Leinster's side, so they still have a shot there, but they've made it difficult for themselves. Now it's very difficult to go to Glasgow, you know, it's a tough place to go and win, and they won, they beat Ulster very, very convincingly on Friday night.
Has the attitude changed since when you were playing with regards to really focusing on the Pro 14 more than they used to? Because like you look at Leinster, and of course the discourse is that they're very lucky because they don't have to focus on the Pro 14 because they're already there and they can focus on April, the weekend of the 20th, 21st of April. But is that the reality for other teams as well? Really, like Munster surely are prioritising the Champions Cup, or has it changed to the point now where actually it is a balancing act?
Yeah, they're Munster in a position of trying to fight for that top spot. Mm. With Glasgow. Glasgow are 3 points ahead of them, so it's huge. It's financially rewarding to get that home semi-final. They would have a home quarter-final. They play an extra match. Away in a semi-final, it's always trickier. If you get that home, if Munster are home semi-final, no matter who they're playing, it's going to be very hard for someone to beat them there in Thomond Park. So that possibly puts you in a final and a 50-50 shot of winning the thing. So it's added benefit of doing that. So
how do you plot that out for the rest of the season?
I think Munster should play. Look, you've got to manage the players, but I think when you get to the business end of the season, the whole scale rotation stops, and you're trying to pick teams to win matches every game you can, unless you're already qualified and guaranteed. Munster have a go to Benetton at the weekend, and that's very, very tricky. They've been the surprise package of the Pro 14 this year, and it's great to see they're sitting in third. It'd be fantastic if they made the playoffs. They've won 10 games, lost 7, drawn 2. Very, very difficult game for them. So what do Munster do? What does Johan van Gran do this weekend? Is he looking ahead to Saracens next week and say, well, I'm going to rotate everybody? Mm. I don't think he can. I think it'd be beneficial to the Munster players to play again, as many of them as they can play together again. So, look, you've got to manage guys with bangs and knocks and bruises. You can't, you shouldn't play them if they're under pressure and it could put them in doubt for the week after. But that's the intriguing part, and that's where squad depth comes into it. Munster squad is deeper this year, and that's why we were talking about Ulster. You know, to kind of compete on both fronts, you need a fair bit of depth. But I just think if you were Munster and you went to Benetton with a weakened side and lost, and then you went to Saracens with your full strength side the weekend, this is me being pessimistic, yeah, and lost again, and then you had the way quarter final, I just think focus on this week and send the strongest team you can to Benetton and try and get a result, and then the following week it'll look after itself. I think the players have been managed pretty well over the season. Obviously you're not going to play guys with potential injuries, but that's the intrigue. I think it's when you're competing on both fronts, and I think Munster can win the Pro 14. They have a better chance of winning a Pro 14 than they have winning a European Cup. I don't mean that now to be disparaging to them, but Saracens obviously is a huge task in Europe. But to compete on both fronts, you need a squad depth. And that's the way it's going to be. That's why these last couple of rounds of Pro 14 are very, very important. You can imagine for Connacht, to have European rugby back in the sports ground is absolutely massive. It's huge.
It's huge for everybody. It's huge for all the players.
It's great for Irish rugby as well. Yeah. And it's what they deserve, you know. And they start filtering players back into the Irish squad. More guys. We saw what happened with Jack Carty this year. From where they were last year.
Yeah, it's a complete turnaround.
You know, it's huge. And Andy Friend deserves a lot of credit for what he's done there to get that feel-good factor back.
Yeah, and fair play to him for getting that right here. You would kind of hope that whatever process led to the hiring of the wrong guy, they've examined that and it'll never happen again. But just to go back to Munster, how did the 9 and 10 play? Because obviously there's significant worry that Carby won't be back in time for the Saracens game. Tyler Blaindall, a really good player who was completely off people's radar for 18 months because of the injuries that he suffered. Yeah, he seemed to play quite well at the weekend.
Yeah, he played well. I think both of them. I think the most pleasing aspect for that would be the most pleasing aspect for Johan van Gran, that both of them played really well. Conor Murray showed glimpses of what he's capable of. He was full of energy, making breaks, taking on people around the side of breakdowns. His passing was good, his speed of delivery, all that stuff was good. It's a different level, for sure, it's down a couple of notches. But he got a heavy knock in the first half. He had a head clash and he went off for a HIA. And I just had a sense that, will Munster keep him off now? Obviously, if the HIA fails, him off. But will they, even if he passes, will they keep him off and try and protect him? And I just thought it was significant that Murray, he wanted to go back out there again. He wanted to get back out in the field. And he's shown a real kind of character and resilience to get back out. And I thought he was superb. He got a try. He was brilliant. Really, really good performance from him. And Blaindell was good as well. And it was a really strong second half for Munster against Cardiff. They were porous at times defensively in the first half. They conceded 3 tries. And the bench made a real impact. Tadhg Byrne, Stander coming off the bench. Niall Scannell. They made a real impact.
Not a bad bench.
It's not, no. And I think that's why I think maybe that's what they'll probably do this week in Benetton. They'll probably rotate those guys who were on the bench, start them and bring put more frontliners on the bench and try and make sure they get the job done against Benetton. And then hope that Leinster can beat Glasgow and Dublin and Munster would go back top, and then it's in their own hands then the week after when in the last game. So they're looking for a favour from Leinster, from our neighbours, to avoid in the semi-final.
Another one?
Yeah, another one. That would mean they'd avoid, Leinster would avoid Munster, and Munster would avoid Leinster in a semi-final.
Yeah.
But potentially they could meet in a final.
Which would work, I think, you know, if you're Leinster.
Glasgow, Edinburgh, Connacht, Benetton maybe will have a bit to say on that, but I think if you could I think the organisers wouldn't mind a Munster-Leinster final, would they?
No.
Just on the Conor Murray thing, like, I'm sure from everything that's happened over the past couple of months, he'll know more than anyone that he needs to be on the pitch regularly, that maybe it's a position-by-position case in terms of resting people this weekend ahead of Europe the following week. Like, rest your back rows, rest your pack, make sure they're fit and ready to go. But we are halfbacks. I wonder, is it a case of getting him on the pitch, get him as far away from rusty as they possibly can be?
Yeah, I think so. If they play again, I think the Munster team need to play as many of the frontliners. Look, I could be totally off the mark here, and they might just decide to rotate and give guys who maybe deserve a chance, who were kind of chomping at the bit and played a lot of those Pro 14s when the internationals were on, and delivered for them.
Yeah, it's like that. So a lot of those Irish players are coming back off a very disappointing Six Nations. Do you want to get them back and get their confidence going and give them another game?
Well, I would play them again.
Are you happy now
could.
With that game and that's them confidence?
No, I'd play them again if you could. Now, I know it'll end up being three. I think the weekend off that they can give them is the last game. If they get the job done this week, and win in Benetton and hope for the other permutation of to happen for him. But like, losing this weekend would be a real bad blow to him. It'd be disappointing, and it would mean it's a little bit easier to give Glasgow a little bit of comfort. They play Edinburgh in the last game at home.
You could always be rope-a-doping Saracens into a false sense of security. Ah, look at these guys. They can't even beat Glasgow. And then it's like...
Yeah, it's match practice though as well, and if you get, I think they'll be better. I think they'll be better the week after if they can get those combinations again playing. Not for the whole game, you know, 40, 50, 60 minutes, whatever the case may be, and bring off the bench then as well. So,
if Van Grant's got something up his sleeve for Saracens, is he working on it this week?
I'm not sure. I think there's always a tailored plan for whoever you play. If you look at the quality of Saracens, it's hard to find weaknesses in them. I think it'll be in the back of their minds, and they'll try not to show their hand fully. You've got to come up with something new, because teams analyse each other so much week on week that you've got to come up with some other strategy to try and... You think of the strategy 2 years ago, and when they played them in the Aviva, it was, you know, kick everything in the air, even when they got an attacking position. So... Saracens countered that, and it looked like a poor, really poor performance from Munster. I think Munster have to back themselves to go and play. I think the best matches I've seen from this group in the last couple of years have been when they've just went at teams just with a real intensity, a real vigour, a real energy, and that's what they'll have to do against Saracens. There'll be no rocket science to try and break them down. They have to physically match them and just play as much as they can for as long as they can. I don't think they did that in Edinburgh, and they'll know themselves in the first half. They didn't play enough, they didn't build enough of phases, and you have to ask questions of good teams. That sometimes they're good teams because teams are not capable of asking those questions. So it's the same in any sport, in football, in GA, in hurling, you know, and so that's what Munster will have to do. So I think the added benefit of most of those guys trying to get those combinations out again this week will be beneficial. It's a Friday night game, so there's enough time to recover for the week after with the travel.
The injury profile that Munster have at the minute is about as good as you're going to get at the end of the season. So Keith Earls missed the game with a bit of tightness beforehand, and obviously we know about Carberry being out, but everybody else is pretty much back, largely fit at the moment.
Yeah, and that's exactly what you want. You're always going to have some injuries. I think the Carberry one would... I don't think he'll make... I find it very unusual if he does make it, because, you know, even to... He won't have a... Unless he makes a remarkable recovery and
plays
against Benetton, I don't think he should... I don't think you can start him against Saracens, particularly the way he came back, missed him about 5 weeks, and then hamstring tightened up after 45 minutes. So we'll see. It'd be great if he can train this week. Maybe he can, and maybe he's back doing active work. But the injury profile isn't too bad for him, and they'll need everyone, because that'll be a bruising encounter against Saracens. You contrast that to some of the serious injuries that Leinster have. You know, they're kind of waiting and hoping that Leo Cullen can have... Henshaw back, maybe Devon Toner, they'd be massive for Leinster to get them back for the business end of the season.
It would transform the team if those two came back, but if they don't come back, I would say that Munster are actually in a better, stronger position just in terms of their available playing talent and the style that they want to have. They're not missing anything, with the exception, obviously, of their first choice 10. Obviously, it's kind of important. But, yeah, feeling pretty confident about the rest of the season from most perspective?
Well, if they get through this weekend, I think the Saracens one is a bonus thing. I think getting to the semi-final is an achievement. And, okay, if you kind of wallow on that and say we're it's brilliant, I just think if they went out in the quarterfinals, it would be seen as very, very disappointing.
Yeah.
They've got to be in the mix, and I think they've got to try and get into a final and give themselves a crack. It's hard to win trophies, you know, it's very competitive, but I think getting into, and that's not being defeatist against Saracens, it's just how good Saracens are. So they can have a real crack at that, but I think Pro 14 has to be a real target for them to try and win a trophy.
Yeah.
And win some silverware. So they're not in bad shape, to be fair. And hopefully they'll be in the mix there.
Alan, good stuff. Thanks for joining us this morning. Talking GAA next, Westmeath are crowned Division 3 champions on Saturday night in Croke Park. Let's hear from Laois manager John Sugar first. He spoke to Mark Trasta after the game and he wasn't happy with his team's performance.
Was there anything going home that you'll be happy with, that you say, yeah, that worked well, or there's some things, was there anything that kind of pleased you that you're able to work on even more?
Tomorrow's a new day, so I'd be happy that tomorrow's a new day, I think.
That's the most Kerry-ish answer now anyone's ever given. Like, there's a phrase in West Kerry, no second amateur, which basically means who knows what's going to happen next. So I'd imagine the drawing board will be fairly full for the next few weeks.
Yeah, and it mightn't be pretty, because I think we all have to look at ourselves and look at what we're doing. Are we going to commit to it 100%, or are we going to commit to it 80%? If we do, we'll wind up with results like today.
Would you say that was a commitment issue, or was it just the fact that you were beaten by a better team?
Well, we've tried to do something, and I don't think we've done it to the best of our ability. So, we really have to focus on ourselves and how well we execute what we're trying to do, and then let the opposition be the opposition. But, you know, like the focus has to be on ourselves and what we're trying to do. So, that's where we need to improve, I think.
I think, though, finally, it's very difficult and naturally difficult to keep a focus when you've got a team and they already know they've been promoted and the hard work is done and they're looking at the next game, which is more important.
It would be if you're under 14s or under 12s or something like that. Do you know, this is senior football and this is Croke Park and this is a place where guys want to play football. If they want to play football, come to Croke Park to play it. Don't come to Croke Park to put up a performance like that.
Are you angry with them?
Well, I'm very disappointed with all of us as a group and how we didn't perform today.
All right, good stuff there from John Sugar, the Laois manager. We'll talk to you about the rest of the stories from the news in a minute, but you were at this game on Saturday
evening. Yeah. It had a kind of a feel about it, Gerard, that it was a league final with both teams, I think, very aware they're about to meet in Championship in a few weeks' time in the quarterfinals of Leinster as well. I know when Mór Trasta asked John about that, John Sugar was very quick to pass that off and saying, look, this is no excuse for the way that we played this afternoon. But for me, just as an observer, you could see that both teams were holding back a bit. Kind of a weird game in a way.
He doesn't seem to be. That doesn't say.
They're meeting in a competition that neither of them have a hope of winning.
Yeah, but I would imagine
a
quarter final probably means as much to them as getting to a Leinster final, even bearing in mind that they're two reasonably local rivals as well.
Getting to a Leinster final has this massive carrot now that you're almost guaranteed, well, not guaranteed, but you've got a 50-50 shot of Super 8.
Yeah.
That sounded like he was pissed off. You might not have heard that clip, but he was very angry with his team. And, you know,
to be fair to John, he's been annoyed after a few games this year as well. It's not as simple as just they didn't perform on one day in Croke Park. He's felt at different times that they've been a little bit passive in possession. I think one of the things that Laois supporters have been a bit annoyed about is that their midfield, they've got John O'Loughlin and Kieran Lillis in the centre of midfield, two players who are really good at bringing the ball forward. But what I observed at the weekend was they were very quick to pass the ball off in terms of the responsibility. Donny Kingston and Evan O'Carroll were winning a certain amount of ball for Laois, particularly Evan O'Carroll. Once Westmeath got a handle on O'Carroll, though, they really struggled to get good ball into their forward line. And Laois, who dominated the first 16, 17 minutes of the game, only had 2 points on the board. They kicked 16 wides, and the more I think about it, the wides they kicked were kicked from terrible angles as well. There was a lot of shooting for the sake of shooting within that game from Laois as well. So I can understand why Laois supporters would be very disappointed. You know, they drifted out of the game in Cusick Park a few weeks ago when the teams met in the regular section as well. They've lost some games where they were in good position Ireland so far this year.
Who won that game?
Westmeath, yeah. So the worry...
Close, or...?
It ended up, I think it was 3 points there and 3 points again on Saturday. Right. So there's not a whole lot between the sides. Obviously, you know, Laois could have easily won this game if it hadn't been for the mistake from Graham Brody in the second half as well. I think he went forward on every single kick out on Saturday.
Just explain that to people who haven't seen what happened, because it was on the news, but I don't think anybody else...
So Graham Brody, effectively, for his club Port Laois and for Laois, is a fly goalkeeper. So when he takes kickouts, he tends to take a second possession and then he goes forward for as long as he can, either in support or to take the possession on again. Brody broke out kind of out in the right wing back position. He tried to take a quick free kick. He was kicking it towards Conor Boyle. Westmeath intercepted the ball, turned it over pretty quickly. Luke Loughlin took the ball in possession and got it across to Gerrigan. Gerrigan finishes into the net, and effectively that was the difference between the sides in the end, because Laois were left chasing a bit in the last 5-6 minutes.
A key point about that was Graham Brody's body language as soon as that happened.
Yeah.
He had his hands in his head and he was standing there. He's like, what have I done? Yeah. Instead of running back to his goal.
He didn't rush back. Now, the thing is, for anyone who's watching, Laois do drop players back. Usually it's one of his clubmates, Garrett Dillon, who would drop back into the goalkeeping position. But the ball from O'Loughlin was so good, or Luke Loughlin across to Egan was so good, he left Egan an easy finish. But you'd wonder, yeah. And I said to Kieran Martin, I was talking to the Westmeath captain yesterday, and I was saying, look, when it comes to Championship and even at the weekend, would you not be tempted to swarm Brody on the occasions that he comes forward?
Yeah. Like, I think Brody's been brilliant, and I thought he was fantastic last summer. I'd certainly be getting back a bit quicker than that. Like, as you say, the swarm tactic of that. I'd be interested to go back.
Take a black card, pull the Westmeath player down.
Potentially. Like, I don't know what it is. There seems to have been... This league hasn't been a great league for the fly goalkeeper, I want to say. Mm. Like, granted, we don't see enough... Like, I'm just thinking that Tyrone's step forward in the second half of the league came at the same time that Niall Morgan was playing as less of a fly goalkeeper, as in he was orchestrating everything at the start of the league when Tyrone were going desperately.
Is this cause and effect, or is this coincidence?
See, it might not be. It could be complete coincidence. I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know. I would need to go back and watch all the games in the league, yeah, but unfortunately, well, that's impossible to do.
John was on at Midland 1-3 after the game.
I'm not available.
Yeah, yeah, it's very difficult to get footage unless you know someone in the stats team to get footage on a team in the lower divisions. But
hey,
John was very quick.
Isn't there a secret drive in RTE that everybody gets access
only for
to?
Only for the championship.
Okay.
Sorry, what's secret
not
drive?
Not anymore, apparently. Yeah. It's with NBC commentators.
Well, John Sugar was quick enough to point out as well, in terms of Brody, he's played 100 games for Laois across league and championship. This has happened twice. He got caught against Leitrim last year. He got caught against Westmeath. And in many ways, it wasn't like he was even caught out. It wasn't like he was turned over in possession. It was just a lax free kick that he played, but fairly crucial in terms of the grand scheme of things in the game as well.
Like, can you beat the same team three times in a year? No, you can't. It's impossible. No one wins three games against like two evenly matched sides, do they? Or do they hammer them now in the third game?
Well, the thing is, we've just started April and Westmeath have brought two trophies home.
Yeah.
Like, and that's not being tongue in cheek. Like, when you talk about their meeting in a couple of weeks and there might be a shadow boxing going on Saturday, I just don't understand that for a single second. Just why I don't understand why people are giving out about Mayo celebrating last week. Like, a trophy is a trophy. We only have so many of them in the GAA. The one that's in the summer is actually a largely ridiculous competition. And for the counties we're competing in Leinster, it's an even more ridiculous competition. Mm-hmm. That was a big evening for Westmeath and Laois on Saturday evening. The O'Byrne Cup was a big deal for Westmeath. They got a Garda escort to Parnell Park for the O'Byrne Cup.
To beat Dublin's 14.
Yeah. It was a big deal. Like, the idea that I said a huge
time for them is not a big thing for them. I think this is a big thing. So I think conflating them actually does it a service to the league.
I think the fact that Westmeath have now played 12 matches before Championship is quite significant, because in previous years they've been dumped out early in the O'Byrne Cup, maybe didn't get as much out of that competition in terms of preparation. Bear in mind they had a new manager, and a manager in Jack Cooney, who started reasonably late because he was still involved with Road in the Leinster Club Championship beforehand. First native manager they've had since the early 1990s as well. Again, Kieran Martin was saying to me yesterday, they find that really important that they actually have someone from the county involved.
He's one of Paudie's disciples, isn't he?
Yeah, so he was involved with Paudie in the backroom team.
The first manager since the 1990s?
Yeah.
From the county, yeah.
You're shitting me.
I'm not. I think you could kind of half count Luke Dempsey as a guy who moved into Westmeath and then became manager.
Yeah.
But in terms of having a native manager, they haven't since the 90s. So it's been a long time coming from that perspective. And Pascal Keelan and Jack Cooney, who worked together in Road to great effect in the Offaly Senior Football Championship, now doing a really good job so far in charge of Westmeath. And they've improved as the league has gone on as well, largely as well because John Heslin and Kevin Maguire have come back into the panel. Heslin, one of the best forwards in the country.
Yeah.
Kevin Maguire, a really important experienced defender in what's a pretty young Westmeath team. And even compared compared to the Laois against Westmeath game in Tullamore last May, I think six of the seven at the back for Westmeath have now changed.
Okay, I don't remember what happened
in a year. Well, Laois went on to win the game, but it's just such a sea change in terms of their defence.
Is that
in
the
a
game
very
with
short
a crazy
time.
Turnaround? Were Laois 10 points down at half time?
I think it was, yeah, was it 9 or 10 points? Yeah, there was a deficit in the first half of that. So Westmeath have changed their defence around, they've changed goalkeeper, changed a lot of the different factors there, and I'm getting Kevin Maguire back in with such a young defence has made a big difference for them.
Wasn't Heslin injured last year?
He came on
as well?
As a sub last year in May, yeah.
Yeah, and wasn't fully fit at any point. But like, if he's fully fit, he is one of the top forwards in the country. So, like, could Westmeath be a Super 8 team? When you think about it, there's no reason why. There's going to be one team from outside the First Division who we expect to make it just because of the way the fixtures tend to throw up two teams against each other. Like, they have to be thinking the form we're in, the momentum we have, the success, the confidence, all that stuff. They've got to be thinking that maybe their team makes a Super 8s.
I think you throw them in the rung just below Donegal and Meath. Like, they're probably a rung above Cork at this point, above Clare at this point, above Tipperary at this point. It's just below the Donegal and Meath thing. I think there might just be a few too little spots for them to actually make it. They do need, I think, two or three fixtures to go their way in the back door and for them to get to the Leinster final, which is a tough ask actually this year given the way Meath have been going. I need to actually check to see what side of the draw they're on, right? Or like, so it could go either way. Leinster is quietly getting a little bit stronger. I do think they just need a couple of fixtures to go their way in the back door to actually make the Super 8s.
And like, Super 8s, I think it has to be the ultimate ambition for them, because they've disappointed in previous years when they've got to Leinster finals. They've been to two and then eliminated in the next round. Okay, they drew Mayo one of the years, which was a difficult draw, but I think when they got Fermanagh, their feeling really was we can get over Fermanagh and get into the last eight in the country. So for the Super 8s, they're going to have to do something similar if they do get to a Leinster final. But you know, I think they're not too far away from being the best of the rest against Dublin. Again, Kieran Martin was saying yesterday, you know, that realistically they're a long way away from Dublin. They've been hammered by them in two Leinster finals with different approaches in both, but the idea is that you just got to aim to try and cut that gap, and then outside of that try and get to the Super 8s.
Westmeath, Laois, Meath, Offaly and Carlow are on the same side of the draw. Heaven forbid there'd be a fairly handy bracket on the Leinster GAA
website. Meath are going to beat Offaly in Navan, I can safely say that, next month. So Westmeath against Meath, be a pretty tasty derby if they meet in the last four.
Worth reiterating, you take Dublin out of the Leinster Championship and it's a pretty good championship.
It would be.
Competitive.
Yeah, certainly. And like, when you think about it, the advances that Carlow have made, that Carlow-Meath game should be decent. Carlo should be able to put it up to Meath.
Should be. They've gone in opposite directions dramatically this spring, but we all know that can be thrown out the window come the summertime.
Alright, well, good stuff. Some big stories to wrap up our sports button. Tom had to run a little bit earlier on, but Leona Maguire is celebrating her first professional win.
Yeah, I suppose it's a breakthrough one. Their second season now playing in America, and she's secured her first professional win of the year. The Cavan golfer won the first playoff hole of the Windsor Golf Classic in California. It's on the Symetra Tour, which is the one below the ladies PGA. She's picked up nearly $23,000 in prize money after the split was made this morning, and now Leona Maguire has gone top of the money list for this year. She's had a couple of other top tens during this season as well, so things moving along very nicely for her there as well.
And was it Paris Saint-Germain miss that we're talking about finally?
Oh, this is insane. That still probably tells enough of where he was when the ball hit his foot.
This is the ball is just
Modding, the former Stoke player.
Yeah, the ball has just rebounded off his left foot. The ball is trickling into goal, trickling, probably going a bit faster than that. Choupo-Moting is in there, just a tap at home, but unfortunately puts his foot in front of the ball rather than behind the ball. You know, the thing you do to actually move the ball towards the goal. The ball bounces out. He gets his feet completely in the mud where he ends up in the net, can't move his feet in time to run back towards the ball to, you know, backing it into the goal. And a defender comes in and actually clears the ball. So he performed a goal line clearance and couldn't do a U-turn quick enough to put the ball in the back of the net.
If that was a defender, you would be remarkably impressed how they actually managed
to get that. You never see the defender not scoring on goal in that position.
Yeah.
It's always like, it was inevitable, there was nothing for him to do. Did they win the game? Did they manage to recover?
I don't know, I just saw the miss.
No.
It's one of those things where you see Twitter
really
and you go,
got into the...
Don't ask a question, you don't know
the subject.
To. Sorry, that's
a two-all draw.
Broadcasting 101. Two-all draw.
It's in Tom's notes here.
There you go.
Strasbourg and Paris Saint-Germain. Two-all have finished.
All right, well, good stuff. Thanks for that. Did you get any sleep in the last 37 hours?
Very little. I slept a little bit yesterday evening, and I'm probably going to sleep this evening, hopefully, for a long time.
Do you set your alarm to wake up for WrestleMania?
Yeah, I started to get up at like, I think about 10 to 12 last night, stayed up, knew I was on the early shift here this morning anyway, so
you're on a
so
rollover.
Let's just power through basically.
What's your name again?
Will O'Callaghan.
Hey, still on, that's all right, doing well. That's all I got time for on OTB AM this morning. If you missed any of the show, we'll seed out loads of it across our social channels. You can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook and on YouTube to get different sections of clips. And if you want to just listen to us and go about your business every morning, you can just log on to offtheball.com, click the Listen Live button and minimise us, and we'll be your perfect accompaniment with breakfast. Off the Ball is back on the radio tonight on News Talk. Tomorrow, Kenny Cunningham is in studio for the morning. Owen and Tommy are off to the north with Off the Wall, and Andy Lee ahead of the return of Game of Thrones next Sunday. You can subscribe to that podcast. Does it have its own podcast feed? It does. The Off the Wall podcast is available now wherever you get podcasts. Like, share, rate, and let the lads know how geeky you think they actually are. If you're, you know, a fellow traveller, then enjoy it. What's Tommy shouting in my ear there? Shout again, Tommy. Will's a big fan of the podcast.
Yeah, I like Game of Thrones, like the podcast as well. So I'm looking forward to listening to Andy's takes. Enjoyed the first episode.
Champions League build-up ahead of Liverpool, Porto and Spurs, Man City, of course, as well. We'll see you tomorrow. Good luck. So if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.